Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today I want to discuss the concept of a Volksstaat. Volksstaat is Afrikaans for the English word ethno-state, basically an ethnic state, a state that is not multiracial, a state that is not multicultural, a state composed of one group of people. So that is what a Volksstaat is. And we're going to look very basically at the concept here in South Africa and places where it's come up. And then I'm going to show you the greatest Volksstaat that ever existed. And you're going to learn a couple of things. So the first time this thing was brought up was in 1994 when we handed over South Africa to the blacks under pressure from the United States, etc. And General Constant Viljoen had suggested that he was going to fight for a country, but how genuine he was, well, that's a whole other story. Anyway, he fell for the trick that Nelson Mandela set for him. Mandela said, no, take part in the election and see what sort of support you get, and then we can talk about it. Anyway, he formed the Freedom Front, and he got 424,000 votes, which is about 10% of the population of the whites. So it was quite high, but apparently it wasn't high enough. A lot of stuff like voting and all that stuff doesn't mean much in the real world. In the real world, power works in other ways, and we'll discuss that on another occasion. But in a nutshell, power is something that you grab, and it depends on how much power you have as to what you get. All these other little things are just silly games that children play. If you're serious, you go and you grab power and you use force to grab it. So there have been some surveys in South Africa, and they did a survey in 1993 and then they did a survey in 1996. In 1993, 29% of the white population supported the idea. Then by 1996, because we were in a very much a liberal phase. South Africa went into its liberal phase towards the end of the 1980s into the 1990s. Jews, liberals, America, the CIA were all pushing the white South Africans away from race towards liberalism. And so we entered this phase of liberalism, and as we got into the 1990s, the whites actually became more and more liberal. But liberalism died within about 10 to 15 years of its creation. Then the whites began to start realizing bit by bit that this is a load of bullshit. So if you look at these statistics, you'll see in 1993, 29% supported the idea. By 1996, it had dropped to 22%. However, if you go further down this article, it says that in 2010, which is quite a long time after that, in 2010, it had gone up from the 22% of 1996 to 56%. 56% of the whites in South Africa said they would move to a Volksstaat if one was created. Only 27% said they would not consider it as a viable option. Now that's a whole other issue. They're not saying that they wouldn't go there, they just don't believe that it could work. And that is probably one of the biggest things that prevents the idea from being taken seriously. However, I'm going to show you the world's greatest folk start that ever existed, and I'll show you what they did to make it work. We're going to have a quick look at it, and you will see that everything that you need has already been invented. And then in 2015, the newspaper Rapport, which is an Afrikaans newspaper, did another survey, and they found that by 2015, 93% of the respondents, so this is not 93% of all the whites, it's just 93% of those who took part in the online survey, said they would support Afrikaner self-determination. Afrikaner and Boer, then we get into that whole story and that whole debate, but just take it that that's the Afrikaans-speaking portion of the country, and they make up the largest portion of the whites in this country. So this idea is growing in strength. Whites are getting sick and fucking tired of the way that they're being treated, and the whites want to do their own thing. And as you will see, all whites on the planet think exactly the same way. But when you listen to liberals and Jews, you will walk away with the impression that only an idiot would consider this. But in actual fact, the complete opposite is true, that most whites on the planet would actually support these kinds of things if they were truly free, which is a whole other debate. But the point is that the number of whites who are considering such a thing is increasing. And it's because this thing is a useless state that's been created. It's anti-white. A bunch of old communist liars are in charge. They are incapable of running the country. They also are malicious towards whites, and they're pushing whites out of stuff. That's what these bastards are doing. It is no wonder that whites are getting sick and tired of it. They're tired of murder, they're tired of crime, and they want to start doing their own thing. But the big thing in South Africa is that because the whites only make up 4.5 million out of about 59 million, the whole issue is this practical? And among the problems that whites face in South Africa is the country is extremely big, and we're actually spread out across the country. That is a very important thing to understand. But we'll talk more about this as time goes by. So this is the Volkstaat flag that somebody's thought up. Though most of the serious people who are into the Volkstaat, they actually want to use the flag of the Boer Republic, of the South African Republic, which was the area that is known as the Transvaal. And here, this map here that you see, you can see somebody has gone, the Freedom Front Plus and the Volkstaat Council have drawn a map where they say the whites should take that area over there. The problem with that area down in the southwest is that it's pretty much semi-desert, there's nothing there, and it's the place that's the emptiest. So that is why they've come up with that. Now, other people have drawn Volkstaat maps, including Dan Roert and his Front National political party. I drew my own map of a Volkstaat a long time ago, and I based it on a war. But these maps are actually fascinating, and they themselves are worth discussing at some point. But in order to understand maps and countries, we need to get on to the issue of warfare, and I really need to tackle the topic of the Portuguese in Angola, because then you're really going to understand what's going to happen. You see, all these maps are all theoretical, and they're based on people assuming that they're going to follow legal processes. The reality is that that is not how a country actually comes into being. Countries do not come into being in that way. Countries come into being through warfare. That's the only way that you create a country, and it's the only way that you keep one. That is how things are done. It's always been done that way. Things that are very important are never discussed. You get your gun, that's how you discuss it. You discuss it with bullets. That's the only way that you can discuss very important things. There is no other way to do your discussion. So here's the flag, and the estimate in 2017 was that this Volksstaat would have 1.5 million Boere Afrikaners. So that was then, but my own view is that the vast majority of whites, if not all whites, should be in such a state. Its population should be 4.5 million. And any whites who do not want to be in it, they should be regarded as traitors and they should be killed. You heard me right. This is a map that will give you an idea of which population groups dominate South Africa and are the highest proportion in certain areas. And this map is very important because this can give you an idea of how things would really work in the real world. You see, in this map, if you look at the left-hand side, you'll see it's mostly green. And that is colored people. They are mixed race people. They are non-whites. And they mostly also speak Afrikaans. They are half-breeds. They are half between blacks and whites. And then this map that is red, that is where the blacks are the majority. So this was where my original thinking about a Volksstaat was that it should be centered on the Cape. And I based it on maps like these, where the blacks are in the north and the west, and the coloreds and whites are in the south, in the southwest. Now, in this map, the next most important thing is that yellow. The yellow areas are the areas where whites make up a certain proportion of the population. And here you will see a very interesting thing. You'll see that there are whites along the coast, down by the Cape and the eastern coast. And then you'll see that in the middle of the country, you'll see areas where whites make up quite a good portion of the population. Right even into the center of the country, where you've got the biggest cities like Johannesburg and Pretoria. So you find whites dotted around the country, and you see whites in all these different places. Now, from my studies of history and military history, I will tell you that you can throw everybody's map out of the window. The only map that's important is a map like this. Those yellow areas are the areas that whites may be able to seize. That is where people will fight. And that is what will actually determine what a Volksstaat will look like. Everybody's map is going to be wrong. That thing that you see there, those yellow areas, that is what is going to determine the Volksstaat. And one of the problems that will come out of this is because the whites are so spread out, what will actually happen is that whites will probably take chunks of territory in various places, and those chunks of territory will not be joined together. They'll seize little bits and pieces here and there, and then they will be they'll be separated from each other. So it makes it difficult, but it's also practical. This is what happens when a country breaks up. And this will happen in America. This will happen in the United States. This is what is coming. They're mixing everybody together, and in the decades to come, in the later years, white Americans will be in a similar position, and they'll be grabbing chunks of territory here and there as America starts breaking up. Africa itself, even the blacks, are still going to break up. Don't worry about these different things. These are things that are coming. And the whites stand a good chance with a lot of things. But anyway, let's move on. We want to look at the Great Folk Start. We will come back and talk about South Africa and the whites of South Africa in other videos. Just to show you that ethnostates have come up in other places, the next place where the concept of ethnostate has come up the most is North America. And various people have proposed ethnostates there. And you've even got guys like Billy Roper with his Shield Wall Network and all sorts of other groups who are around, and people are looking at different chunks of territory. Mainly, some of them are looking at the Pacific Northwest. Again, these things don't matter. What matters is how many guns you have, how many men you have, that will determine your territory. And it can easily be, in fact, it is a certainty that the actual borders of any ethnostates in South Africa and North America and wherever else the thing comes up, Canada, Australia, Europe, etc., Britain, whatever ethnostates are created will be created and held by white men who are armed. And my bet is that they're going to be able to seize bigger chunks of territory than you think. So people think, oh, we're just going to take this little piece. No, it depends on what you are capable of militarily when the time is right. So here is another discussion about it. This is all from Wikipedia. Here you can see South Africa is mentioned, and they mention places like Orania and even the Bantustans, because under apartheid, we allowed the blacks to have their own states. Though, and that's interesting, under apartheid, we allowed blacks to have their own states. Their states were known as Bantustans, or homelands. Now, under black rule, you'll see that whites are not allowed a Bantustan or their own state. In fact, I would have said to people, you know, we should go to the government and say to them, give us a Bantustan. In fact, give us one of your Bantustans that we gave you, and also give us money for our Bantustan the way that we gave you money for your Bantustan. You know, give us a piece of territory and give us a budget from the government. Then, and you watch what we do in a Bantustan. And of course, they will never do that. They'll never do that because they know that if they let the whites get a piece of territory, that it's going to be a success. So they will never, never allow it. Never. Australia was very clever. For 72 years, from 1901 to 1973, Australia had a policy called the White Australia Policy, and it was to ensure that Australia is taken over by whites. And just like America, its policy was destroyed, and in this case, it was destroyed in 1973. In America's case, their immigration policy was destroyed by the Jews in the mid-1960s. Jews do not like it when whites want to live together. Jews, like gypsies, are the garbage races of Europe. Gypsies are like the blacks of Europe. They're the low-level scum. Jews are a high-level kind of a parasite. Anyway, it mentions the United States, and below it, you see another country, Nazi Germany. Ah, Nazi Germany. Isn't that funny, eh? Nazi Germany, also an ethnostate. And it says, Adolf Hitler's plan was to create a Nordic Aryan superstate that would rule over most of Europe and dominate its geopolitical landscape and eradicate anyone who is not considered pure by the Nazis. And it goes on to say that they were going to genocide and mass deport people like Jews and Slavs. I doubt that. In the previous video I did, I've shown you all the details of the German plans to get the Jews to Madagascar, and that the final solution was not the gassing of the Jews, was not the fake gassing of the Jews, it was to send them to the east. They went to the east. They went to Poland, Russia, etc. But anyway, but the goal was to make it an ethnostate. Yes. So the greatest physical ethnostate that's ever existed is Nazi Germany. And that's what we're going to take a look at. This is that map of South Africa that I've mentioned. This is the one by the Freedom Front showing their drawing. But you can consider all these things as just speculation. Now, this photo is a photo that was taken at the funeral of the late Eugene Terblanche of the AWB. It's basically the Afrikaner resistance movement. When he died, this is what the whites were doing at his funeral. Isn't it funny? What are you seeing here? You're seeing Boere Afrikaners, and is it my imagination, or are they doing a Nazi salute? Not a common thing in South Africa, but check it out. All these people giving him a Nazi salute here in South Africa. There you go. Nazi salute from the Boere Afrikaners. And just to give you a little bit of background, with all this talk of ethnostates and, you know, screw the diversity and diversity is not our strength, I just want to point you to one of the greatest and most accurate predictions made by a Nazi, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda. And propaganda in Nazi Germany was not about lying, it was about telling the truth. Everything that Hitler and Goebbels said, you can go and check up on it and you'll see that they told the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. The lying came from the Anglo-American Jewish-controlled world. That's where all the lying came from. And from the Jewish-controlled Soviet Union. That's where the lying came from. And if you should wonder why in World War II, did Britain, which is apparently a free country, align itself with a communist state like the Soviet Union? Why would America, a free Western country, align itself with the communist state of the Soviet Union? Well, it turns out that the factor that ties Britain, America, and Russia together is Jews. Jews. That's the little thing. That's the thread that ties those countries together. And that's what tied them together against the Nazis and the fascists. Anyway, before Dr. Goebbels and Hitler died, in January in about January 1945, in an article that Dr. Goebbels wrote. He wrote an article predicting what the world would be like in the year 2000. And he himself was to die a couple of months later along with Hitler. And Dr. Goebbels wrote, "Humanity would sink into eternal darkness, and it would fall into a dull and primitive state were the Jews to win this war." Now look around South Africa today. Look at America, look at Britain, look at Europe. And are we not in a dull and primitive state? Indeed, Dr. Goebbels was right. And just to show you that ethnostates are more common than you think, this is a map of Canada in red, and you see the blue on the east coast, that is Quebec, and it is dominated by the French. And the French have wanted so much to get the hell out of Canada. When I went to Canada, I met the French Canadians for the first time, and I must tell you, I took quite a big liking to the French Canadians. I really like the French Canadians. They have got a nice attitude, they've got a go-getter attitude. In many ways, strangely enough, they are similar to Americans. They are confident of themselves, and they've got quite an energetic attitude. I like the French Canadians, really I do. And the French Canadians have tried to break away from Canada on a couple of occasions, and they've been cheated out of it. They've had elections where they voted to get out of Canada, and then there was a little bit of trickery in those elections that was discovered afterwards, very much like communists and Jews and liberals at work. And those French Canadians have been trying to get the hell out of Canada as much as the whites of South Africa want to get out of black rule. But the French Canadians are pretty kick-ass. And one of my English supporters in Canada actually told me that if you study Canadian history, you'll actually find that those French Canadians are actually the most kick-ass people in the history of Canada. Those French Canadians are really the movers and shakers of Canada. And in various wars and all kinds of difficulties, the French Canadians are the ones who throw themselves in with energy and they really get rocking. Among the greatest Canadians are French Canadians, even though they only make up a small portion of the population, like 10% or something. In that sense, Canada is a lot like Austria in the time of Hitler. Austria in the time of Hitler, Germans only made up 10% of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Germans were kick-ass. And it's pretty much the same in South Africa. You've got a small group of people in a bigger nation, and that group is energetic. And in South Africa's case, it is whites, and more specifically, it's the Afrikaans-speaking whites. They regard South Africa as theirs, and they take it seriously. So you'll find these kinds of people, you'll find that even in countries where you've got whites, that you have a little bit of grading that's slightly different. The British are much more sheep-like and can be herded and controlled more easily. Not so the French. And I quite like them, I must tell you. I like the French. In fact, when I was in Canada, I thought to myself, if it should ever be that Canada is going to become non-white, then all the English speakers in Canada, who are the majority in that red area, the English speakers in Canada should maybe go to the French speakers and say, hey, Can't we all stand together in Quebec and we turn Quebec into a white ethno state? That was my thought for Canada. So before the English lose all of Canada, go and join up with the French and tell them you'll fight for a French Quebec as an ethno state. Unfortunately, the bad news about Canada is that whenever a country or a territory does very well, like the French were doing in Quebec, guess who rocks up, guess who comes in and gate crashes your party? Jews. Jews have been pouring into Quebec, and Jews are busy fucking up Quebec. Jews doing what Jews always do. They take a good country, a good piece of territory where the whites have got their act together, and they come and they fuck it up for everyone. Well, they come and fuck it up for the whites, and then they jump on planes, trains, and ships, and they fuck off out of there when everything's gone to hell in a handbasket. Just like the Jews have done in South Africa, just like they did in Germany, etc. So, Jews been fucking up Quebec, screwing with the heads of the leaders of the French, so cocking it up for the whites as always. Here is the Quebec referendum in 1995. They actually did one, I think, in 1979 or 1980. They had an election, the French voted for secession and for getting out of Canada. They actually had a majority, but they were cheated out of it. They were totally cheated out of it. And if you want to see another rigging, look at these 1995 results. Isn't it strange that the yes vote fell just slightly short of 50%, 49.42%. I bet you there was rigging there, and if it hadn't been rigged, it would have been higher than 50%. And French Canadians told me that the election in 1979 or 1980 had been totally rigged. After the event, they found out that they had a majority, but it had been rigged and it was too late, over and done. Democracy is a piece of shit. The way that it's handled, whites are not allowed to make their own decisions. Jews, liberals, communists come, globalists, Freemasons, they come and they fuck it up for the whites who want to do their own thing. So, for all whites everywhere, when you want to do your own ethnostate thing, you're going to run into Jews, and more Jews fucking it up for you, creating enemies for you, screwing everything up for you. Rest assured, all whites who want an ethnostate will face the hell that the Germans faced. You will. And you only have to even look at our recent history to see apartheid. Look at the resistance that the whites had under apartheid, under colonialism. Jews. They don't like nationalism. They hate nationalism. They want globalism and multicultural, multiracial stuff. This is from Faith Goldie in America. She recently said, and in America, the pressure is growing among the white right. And Faith Goldie said, what if all the conservatives, white advocates, immigration patriots, and Christian gun owners simply moved out? And she's also basically hinting at ethno-state type activities. So let's go take a look at the Germans. And you know the Germans as Nazis. So what exactly is their system? Well, Nazi is a horrible Jewish abbreviation for National Socialism. The Germans never called themselves Nazis. In fact, there never even was a political party called the Nazi Party. There was no such thing. The actual political party that they had was called the NSDAP. And the concept, the political concept, was called National Socialism. And National Socialism is not just another silly flavor of democracy and nationalism as we know it. It's not just a silly thing. The Germans, who do many excellent things and who do many good things and who invent tons and tons of stuff, well, the Germans went and they invented something in politics that's damn good. It's as good as some of the best stuff that they've ever built. They actually revolutionized politics. And they came up with concepts so advanced, so new, and so threatening to the existing Jewish, elite, Freemason, globalist type of Western nation that Jews immediately zoomed in on this thing to destroy this thing. So National Socialism is not just politics as usual. This thing is very deep and they've done lots of thinking. And if you want an ethno-state, whether you're in South Africa or anywhere else, to do an ethno-state and not study the Nazis, you're an idiot. Because you'll find out that those 70 million Germans who had the world's greatest ethno-state, those 70 million Germans put a lot of thought and effort into this thing. You have intelligent white people, hard-working white people, and they came up with a system for themselves. It wasn't for export, it was for themselves. They invented a system that they were going to live under. And it's a great system. They put lots of thought into it. So, on this slide it says, nationalism is the individual's responsibility towards the community and their love for the country. But National Socialism is a very specific design. And I think it's the best design of all. Racialism and National Socialism actually have scientific origins. Again, you'll hear all the time liberals and Jews lying through their teeth and they'll say, oh, you see, racism, it's all old-fashioned stuff. No, it's not. Racialism and the understanding of race is something that came directly from Darwin, from Charles Darwin and evolution. Evolution is the thing that led to the concept of races. And scientific racism is a direct result of evolution. It is a scientific concept. It is not an emotional concept. It is based on logic and science and the study of history. And that is the important thing. You are dealing with firm facts. You're not dealing with emotion. You're not dealing with fairy tales. You're dealing with firm facts. That's what you're dealing with. So here's another image that I got where somebody said National Socialism and the religion of nature. When you're dealing with National Socialism, you're dealing with things that are natural and things that are real. And they had a view of nature that you could call naturalism. And as we get into this, you will see that this thing sounds strange at first, but I'm warning you, when you understand National Socialism, you will find, as I did a couple of years ago, once I started grasping it, you will suddenly realize that National Socialism is like putting on an old pair of comfortable shoes. You'll find it fits so well, and your feet slip into it, and it's so nice and comfortable. That is what National Socialism is for whites. And whites love it. Blacks won't like it. Jews will hate it. Jews don't like hard work. Jews don't like... There are lots of concepts in there that Jews don't like. And they're not interested in it. And blacks also not that keen on it. But for whites, this thing fits in with the natural psyche of white people. And everything you've heard about Nazis, Hitler, World War II, you've just been told a whole bunch of lies. And you can even go and do your own homework and you'll see these are lies, provable lies. And once you understand the facts, you'll see that the Germans were not only right, they were reasonable, they actually were trying to do good things, they were actually trying to save themselves. And another thing about National Socialism is it's not a system thought up by elites for the people. It is a system thought up by common white people. National Socialism is a system for the majority of common white people. The majority of common white workers will love the system. You'll love the system. You won't just like it a little bit. You won't just debate it. Oh, well, you know, this is almost like liberalism, but slightly different to conservatism. No. Once you understand this thing, you will freaking love this thing. It is fantastic. It is the most intelligent system thought up by whites, for whites, and it fits like an old pair of shoes, man. You'll see that this thing, once you understand it, you'll say, oh man, that is so good. That is so good. It solves this problem. It overcomes that thing. They solved every problem that there was. You see this lady here in front of you, this white lady. Her name is Savitri Devi. I'm not sure if there's a little bit of Indian in her. It's possible. But Savitri Devi was a woman who was also linked to India, and she was a National Socialist, and she wrote books about National Socialism. So this good-looking white woman wrote about National Socialism, and she explained various things. Now here is a quote from her, and this will also give you some insight into how little white people know about their own origins. Most white people know nothing about their origins. She wrote this: Hinduism is the national religion of India, and there is no real India besides Hindu India. Now, let me tell you something. White people in ancient times, known as Aryans, conquered India. And they created apartheid. Yes, white people created an apartheid system in India that exists in India to this day. That apartheid system is known as the caste system. And it puts people into various levels and they're not allowed to intermarry and move outside those levels. And that system exists in India to this day. And those white people, those Aryans, created a religion around this whole thing. And they created a religion and a caste system so that they could control all of India and all the non-whites. And they were successful with their apartheid system for 600 years until they began interbreeding with the non-whites. But in India to this day, if you go and you look at the upper classes of India, you'll see that their skin is much lighter. You'll see that people in the north of India have lighter colored skins than in the south of India, and that all their upper classes are lighter skinned. And that is the DNA from the Aryans. So, just like the whites of South Africa created apartheid, that also is natural and normal. Though everybody will run around and the Jews will go shrieking and the liberals will go shrieking that all of this is evil and racist, but in actual fact, it's totally natural. When white people are doing their own thing and they're totally natural, then they do these kinds of things. And so now you've got the Jew who's forever a nuisance and a parasite, and it doesn't suit the parasite. But it does suit white people and it works for white people. However, the parasite works against it. So here's another quote from Savitri Devi. It says, "Somebody once asked me what had attracted me to National Socialism. I replied without a shadow of hesitation, it's beauty." And she's so right. Once you understand National Socialism, you don't have all the garbage that you have with liberalism and conservatism. Liberalism is the worst of the lot. But you don't have any of the nonsense that you have with communism and liberalism and all that rubbish. You'll find it's a beautiful system. It's fantastic. Now here is the most important quote, and I'm going to hammer this one home to you again and again. This one from Savitri Devi. She says, "One does not become a national socialist. One only discovers sooner or later that one has always been one." Let me repeat it. One does not become a national socialist. One only discovers sooner or later that one has always been one. So that is what I uncovered a couple of years ago. I began to realize, you know what? All this thinking in the system is actually similar to the way I've been thinking for much of my life. I just didn't know that there was a name for it. And the name is Nazism or National Socialism. And that is exactly what she's saying. You will discover that this thing was made for you. Yes, those clever, clever Germans invented a system that is fantastic, and all whites will like it. Just to give you some more insight from Savitri Devi, she says the following, and this will give you an idea of the way that a National Socialist views nature, the world. How do you look at the world? And she says, "I worship impersonal nature, which is neither good or bad, and who knows neither love nor hatred." And that is correct. The animals out there are neither good nor bad. They do not love you, nor do they hate you. They do what they need to do in order to survive. And the world and the universe is neither good nor bad. It does its thing. Sometimes it'll work for you, sometimes it won't. If a meteor were to hit the earth and kill a whole bunch of us, it's not that the meteor hated us. It's just the way the universe works. And so that'll give you some kind of an idea of how National Socialists view the world. You get away from these thoughts of good and evil. You look at other things and you'll see the world you'll see the world through totally different eyes. And once you do, you will realize all kinds of things that you've never seen before. You see, National Socialism is more than just an economic system. It's more than just a political system. It is a philosophy of life. And it's a very powerful philosophy. This thing is designed for whites, for people of European descent. It's a way that white people can live together and work together so that there is a benefit for everybody. It is a system of teamwork that is unequaled in history. There have been National Socialist systems in other white tribal areas in ancient times. The Spartans who were a tribe of Greeks, They had a system, a political system, that was like an early form of national socialism. And in this system, you will see reflections of other structures. You'll see reflections of the Greeks. You'll see reflections of the Romans. Anyway, another Savitri Devi quote, she says, "Creation and destruction are one to the eyes who can see beauty." And that's important. You're starting to get into the philosophical stuff. And when you get into Nietzsche, who's very important, then you'll realize that in order to move forward, you need to destroy certain things, and then you'll create better things. That is the way that all of history has worked. It's always worked that way. There is destruction and then creation. You destroy the existing and you create something even better. Whites have done this over and over again all across the world. It's natural for us, and once you move beyond some of this good and evil stuff, then you start looking at the world and you see it in a whole different way. Now, in this photo, you see a movie, and this guy is a Roman soldier. And look at the way that he's holding his arm. He is saluting in the Roman style. That is how the Roman army, which in ancient times was the greatest army in the world, and the Roman army, every army on the face of the earth, is actually based on the Roman army. No army fought as much as the Roman army. It was one of the most incredible creations of white men. And the Roman army and the Roman state are very important inspirations for whites. But the key thing here is notice he holds up his right arm at an angle, and I'll bet you've seen that somewhere else. Yes, there you see Adolf Hitler, and what is he doing? He's doing a Roman salute. What you know as the Nazi salute is the Roman salute. And actually, there you can see it as well. Another thing that you've heard the liberals and Jews spitting blood at concepts like fascism. Ooh, it's so evil, fascism. Well, that thing that you see in front of you, that is known as a fasces, and that is a Roman symbol. That has to do with the law. It has to do with, I think, a type of axe that's got something wrapped around it. But the fasces is a symbol of the law. So when they say to you, ooh, fascism, it's so evil, it's so evil. No, it's Roman, okay? And even in a place like South Africa, we have Roman Dutch law. A whole chunk of our legal system comes from the Roman Empire because it was so damn good. There you see Benito Mussolini. He was a fascist. And look at the salute he's doing. It's actually the Italian fascists who came up with that salute in honor of the Romans, and then the Nazis copied it from them. So that's where that thing comes from. So that is a recognition and a use of a Roman thing. So it's well within our culture, within our race, that is something that was done by one of the greatest empires ever created by whites. So here is Adolf Hitler, and you see little white German girls, and they're doing their Nazi salute. And Hitler knew the importance of children and family. And oh my goodness, the Jews will tell you, no, if you're a right winger, if you're an old-fashioned Nazi, if nobody really likes that stuff. Well, apparently a whole bunch of people do, eh? Look at that. Look at that enormous crowd and all those German men doing Nazi salutes. So see, it's not as unpopular as you think. Once all whites understand it, all whites on the planet will be doing it. And here you can see the same thing. Look at all these whites doing their Roman salute. Look at that. All these Germans. And we'll discuss the swastika which is hanging there. We'll discuss that shortly. And here are all the little boys, little German boys doing their Roman salute. And all these women doing their Roman salute. And as you can see, a lot of people liking this stuff. And there you can see a poster from the time of Hitler's Germany. And you can see these white girls. And look out there. Do you know at one of Hitler's speeches, more than a million people pitched up to attend. A million people to come to one place to listen to one man. And there it will give you an idea of how popular he was. Is National Socialism such a bad thing? Is it such an unpopular thing? I don't think so. It's just that you've been told endless lies about it. Ah, and here we see little German girls with their swastikas. And how evil are these Nazi girls looking to you, hey? They're just little white girls, and they're looking real happy, and they're looking healthy. And look at these lovely little girls. And they're all doing their Roman salute, hey? Isn't that cute? Here you can see white women doing their Nazi salute. And look at these soldiers and girls and those big, big smiles on their faces. Aren't they happy-looking people? A German friend of mine said to me, he's Christian, so he measures Germany's age by Christianity, and he kind of ignores Germany before it was Christian. So he says, in the 1,400 years of German history, the German worker was never happier than under National Socialism. This is a system that doesn't benefit the billionaires and the Jews and the super rich. It's a system for the common people that makes their lives easier and gives them more benefits than they had under the previous system. It is a system that is efficient. It's very efficient, very productive. But you got to know your place. Everybody gets his place, and you've got your work to do, and you'll see the work that they do. And they are happier. These people are happier than they've ever been. So there you can see Hitler and some of the leaders. There you can see a whole bunch of people, men and women, doing their Roman salutes. And if you look carefully here, look at some of these. I assume these guys are like police. And they are holding these people in. And look at how happy those women are. And everybody's smiling. Doesn't look like they're that unhappy, eh? Look at how ecstatic they are, and even the police are enjoying it. The leaders. And look here. Girls, boys, everybody saluting. Here is Goebbels. Those little children in front of him are his children. More photos to show you. Pretty popular system, eh? Intelligent. These are intelligent, hard-working whites, and they love this system. Look at these girls. They're almost losing their minds over this German soldier. Look at that. Happy, happy people. And people loving their system. How's this? Nazi girls on the beach. Having fun. And the children and their teachers, the little girls. And by the way, no transgenders here. No faggots, no pedophiles. Homosexuals are thrown into concentration camps. You don't want fucking homosexuals around. And you definitely don't want pedophiles around. So, boys are boys and girls are girls. And you don't need anything more than that. You can see children in a school. And look at this. Look at these wholesome, lovely, young white girls. Looking happy, looking healthy. What more do you want? And then every now and then we stumble on, you know, some Jewish bullshit. So you'll get stuff like this. Notorious female Nazis. Now look at these evil white women. And these are their names. Binz, Koch, Zimmer. So, you know, why would a white woman be a notorious, hideous thing? Well, that's because when it comes to children, that's when the tigress comes out of women. When an adult woman sees children, she becomes motherly and protective, and if she believes in her system, she is going to be totally committed to it. So Nazism attracted women, and it took women and turned them into tigresses. And that's fine. They're there to protect the children. So let's see some of the things that these women did. And by the way, Germany had men and women voting. It was a democratic system. And with men and women voting, the Nazis came into power. So women also voted for the system. Women loved the system. So here's a little piece from an article. It was, and in this title it said, "The Woman Who Gave Birth for Hitler." And it goes on to say, in 1936, a Nazi supporter and school graduate was recruited as one of Germany's racially pure women, chosen to have sex with SS officers in the hope of producing an Aryan child. She was part of a state-supported program called Lebensborn, meaning the Fountain of Life, a Nazi initiative to counteract falling birth rates in Germany and produce a master race in accordance with Nazi eugenics. These people, and this is why when you're talking about whites, you got to understand that we are animals no different from cattle and horses, etc. Whites have been breeding animals for thousands of years. Whites domesticated animals about 9,000 years ago. And whites have been breeding animals and creating animals for our own use. Cattle, horses, and look at all the things we've done with dogs and cats. Every single breed of dog and cat that exists is unnatural. It was created by whites who bred those animals in that way. You do not get a bulldog and a poodle and a collie naturally occurring in nature. These animals were bred to be like that, and whites bred them. Whites have bred all different kinds of cattle, sheep, you name it. Whites have done intensive breeding of animals. However, never at any time have whites sat down and thought, If we can take animals and breed better animals, why can't we take people and breed better people? Why can't we pick specific men and women to create new children that are maybe even better than the ones that we have? And so this is where the natural side of it comes in. There is also marriage as normal. Lots and lots, vast amounts of people were married. Men and women were married and they had children. The Nazi system is the most family-friendly government that existed in the history of the world. Adolf Hitler was the most family-friendly leader that ever existed. Everything was done for the children, genuinely, properly. Women were having lots of children. White women were having lots of children. But then over and above that, there was a special program. Now the SS, whom you've also heard nothing but evil things about, the SS was there as the future elite. They were taking the best of the men and the women to create an elite who would be the future leaders of society. That's what they were doing there. In the current world, the elite is anybody who's got money. If you've got money, then you can decide the future. So non-whites, Jews, faggots, pedophiles can work on the future of the Western world. In Germany, that was not the case. People were chosen and trained properly. So you had a proper conscious system that bred the future, that looked to the future for white people, for the benefit of whites. You don't have some fucking faggot and some non-white preparing the future that will be a future without whites. Here you can see white women and their babies. Children were highly valued by the system. Children are the heart of the system. Lots and lots of little white children are coming out of that system. You're not having mixed races. You've got white children coming from white parents. Here is Dr. Goebbels on the right. And there's Hitler. And there you can see, that's Dr. Goebbels' wife, and those are his children. Those are Nazi children from a Nazi leader. See, it's totally natural. Normal people. No pedophiles, no faggots, no mixed race. Here is Adolf Hitler, and this is the woman that he married in the end. This is Eva Braun. Nice looking young lady. Doesn't look like Hitler was doing too bad, don't you think? See, Hitler wasn't a pedophile. He was having sex with a lovely young white woman. Very natural. Totally natural. These people are natural white people, healthy white people. So let's take a little bit of a closer look at our symbol of white power here. Some people use symbols like these, and you can see a swastika there, and you can see an eagle. Both of those have got a place in the history of whites. They are well and truly important. In this photo that you see here, you can see some reenactors or somebody from a movie where they are Roman soldiers. And they are dressed exactly the way that the Romans dressed. In fact, they've got those lion's heads on them. And that soldier is carrying a standard. And on the top of that standard is an eagle. The Roman army carried standards with eagles into battle. And that is where the eagle comes from in the Nazi symbols. But you'll find the eagle everywhere. You'll find the eagle exists in America. You'll find that Napoleon had eagles. So whenever you see eagles coming up in a white country, It's because of the Roman influence. It's just going back to our traditions. So here's a lovely young lady, and she's got some swastikas there. And let's take a look at a swastika. Swastikas are very ancient symbols, and they've been found all around the world. And if you look on this map, you'll see all the places where swastikas have been found. You'll see that swastikas have been found all over Europe, even in Britain. You'll see that swastikas have been found in India, that there've even been a couple found in China and Eastern Asia, that swastikas even appeared in North America. It's a very, very old symbol. It's actually a sun symbol. We are sun worshippers. That's where this thing comes from. And here are swastikas from all around the world that have been found. You can see they're in India, Russia. You can see even in Iraq. Etruscan civilization had swastikas. Hittites, I think that's Hittite. Peru, Tibet, Poland, Thracians, that's an old civilization. You can see from Iran, you can see from Korea, you can see from Italy, Armenia. You can see from the Aztecs. So swastikas, lots of them. Now, the Germans also had non-German whites in the German army, and they were known as the Waffen-SS. The Waffen-SS was like the German version of the French Foreign Legion. The only difference is it was much bigger and much more successful than the French Foreign Legion or anything that any other country has come up with. The Waffen-SS was 1 million strong. And of the 1 million, 600,000 were non-Germans. Lots and lots of non-Germans joined the German army to fight for Hitler. Among them were Dutch and French. And you can see here one of the divisions, SS Viking. These are guys from Scandinavia. You see this German soldier? This guy is Leon de Grel. Leon de Grel is not a German. Leon de Grel is Belgian. So the Belgians and the Dutch, they used to be one country. So he's a Belgian. He was actually a Belgian politician. And he was so impressed with these Germans and with National Socialism, that he went and joined the German army. Right at the end, he even became a general. He was given an award for exceptional bravery. And Hitler even said to him, "If I were to have a son, I would want him to be like you." That's what Hitler said to a Belgian. So there's General Leon de Grel, or he was to become a general, fighting for the German army. One of 600,000 non-German white men who fought for Germany. So here you can see another one. 5th Waffen-SS Panzer Division Viking. So there were lots of these different divisions. And after World War II, you even had Nazi parties in other countries. This is the Nazi Party of America. The guy in the middle is George Lincoln Rockwell, the guy with the suit. That's George Lincoln Rockwell and his little American Nazi Party. And he was killed later by Jews. They won't tell you that, but it was two Jews who assassinated him. Jews tried to kill him, and they went after him twice, just like they did with Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd of South Africa. We'll get back to that story. But there was a little American Nazi party in the 1950s, 1960s. George Lincoln Rockwell. There was even a Canadian Nazi party. Even in South Africa, there were organizations like the Grey Shirts, which was a type of Nazi party. And you had the Osservaal Brandwag, which was Afrikaans, which was also a type of Nazi organization. Here is an Irish football team in 1941 doing a Nazi salute. This stuff belongs to our race as a whole. People of European descent, here is the system that was invented, a system invented for all whites. And as you see more, you'll understand why the system is so great. So the crux of the system was that it was focused not on capital, not on how much money is in the bank so that the rich can control you. It is actually focused on the worker, the white worker. That's what it's focused on. Now, you've heard all these stories from these lying Jews, lying crybaby Jews. Oh, Hitler killed 6 million of us. That in and of itself is a total lie, but let's not go there today. But this photo that you see here is of Auschwitz, okay? This is the death camp that the Jews claim they were all killed in, okay? Not all of them, but most of them, or huge numbers of them. However, for a death camp, just be aware that all those buildings that you see there, Jews were in those buildings. So it's kind of funny that if you want to kill them, that you actually put them in housing like that. But the most important thing in this picture that I want to show you is this sign at the entrance to Auschwitz. There in German, you can see from left to right are three words. And those words are Arbeit, Macht, Frei. And it'll sound a bit like Afrikaans there. Arbeit is work, and it's basically work sets you free. So it's not a death camp, it's a work camp. All these criminals, communists, Jews, traitors, and so forth were sent to work camps. But the concept is that work sets you free. That was a big thing of the Germans and the Nazis. And they didn't just apply it to the lazy, filthy Jewish communists. They applied it to themselves. So you see a thing like this. The Reich Labor Service. So if you want to start an ethno state, in our ethno state we need a labor service. Because until we get to the point where we've captured enough non-white prisoners of war to use as slaves like the Romans and the Greeks did, which I'm all in favor of, by the way. I'm all in favor of a return to slavery. I'm a total believer in it. I say you can take your enemies, turn them into slaves. If they give you any problems, kill them. But anyway, you also need to get the white guys to learn how to do some work. And what the Germans had was the Reich Labor Service. And here you can see, what do you see? White men with shovels. Yeah? So not only did they put the Jews to work, they actually put the Jews to work in factories. These white guys are actually going to do even harder work. They're going to be building roads. They're going to be draining marshes, preparing farmland. They're going to do bloody hard work. White guys, that is their system. All those spades. Look here, all these white men. These are not slaves, these are Germans. This is what white men do when they don't have blacks and slaves. But there are good reasons to also do this. We need to get into the habit of doing more of our own things. Then we aren't dependent on blacks who can turn on us. So here you can see the Reich Labor Service. Lots and lots of intelligent, hard-working white males going to do some unpleasant tasks. Not a lazy people. Here are more. These are not prisoners of war. These are Germans. They're Germans and they're off to go and do some work. They're going to do infrastructure work that's good for Germany. Here are more of them. So these are Hitler's guys with shovels, white men with picks and shovels. Not lazy people, not fat people either. Here is Hitler at the inauguration of the Autobahn, and there he's busy with a shovel. And Adolf Hitler himself, earlier in his life, he worked in the building industry. He worked with a pick and a shovel and a wheelbarrow. So he created a system for the worker because he and the others were workers. These are white men who had to go and work with their hands, and they went and created a system that would work for all white people. And it makes them independent and strong. They're not dependent on blacks who can strike and who always have to be among you, robbing you and stealing from you. They can take care of themselves. It's a male system. It's a male-dominated system. And this is one of the autobahns, the first highways, you could say, of Germany. Look at those autobahns. And do you see that those VW Beetles in this picture? The VW Beetle was invented by Adolf Hitler. He laid down the design for that vehicle, the exact design for it. So if you see a VW Beetle, that is a Nazi product, and the actual design of it was drawn up by Hitler himself. You're looking at the products of Nazis here. Now here are some good-looking young white women, Nazis, looking healthy. And take a look at this. Look at what the girls are doing. Exercises. No fat people there. Look at these lovely young women. Exercising because everybody works. In Germany, you get up off your ass and you go and do some work. And more young ladies doing their exercises. This is the Nazi system. Isn't it interesting and healthy? Lovely young women. They're healthy. They're going to be good mothers. Look at these young girls. Looking healthy, fit, attractive. Now that lady with the black dress that you see there, her name is Gertrude Scholz-Klink. Now that lady is the woman in charge of the female side of the German labor service. Adolf Hitler called her the perfect woman. That woman that you see in black. She was in charge of all the girls. Germany was a male-dominated state, but you can see that when it came to women's affairs, they put a woman in charge. And look at these lovely young white girls with their swastikas, and aren't they looking happy? I couldn't help but insert this here. This is so good. I found this a couple of years ago, and I've lost it more than once, and I don't even know where to find it again, even though it's on my website. But somebody put this meme together, and every now and then I think about this meme. This thing is so freaking good. Somebody did this in 2012, an American. And the top says, "Bet you never guessed you were fighting for this, stupid white man." And it shows an American GI on the bottom. And it says, "He fought so hard to win." And there it is, 1944. And meanwhile, in 2012, the blacks are sleeping with your white American women. Some of them having babies with them. And how did that turn out for you, American man? But hey, if you want the dumbest people of World War II, the British. In Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler said, that he has no intention of any conflict with the British Empire. He's in favor of the British Empire, etc. He tried to make peace with the British many times. The British carried on and on and on with this stupid war. And in the end, Germany had already lost its overseas empire in World War I. Everybody else in Europe had an empire, and the British had the biggest one, including territories that had belonged to Germany. And at the end of World War II, everybody lost everything. The British lost the biggest empire on earth, all because of stupid World War II. And they didn't even have to fight the Germans. They could have just carried on, left Hitler alone, he'd have left them alone, and there was nothing to fight for. So if you want the dumbest people of World War II, the British, definitely. They lost everything. For no reason at all. Hitler's 2RC even flew to Britain to make peace, and the British threw him in jail. So much for that. British have no honor. They pandered to the Jews, and they fought a war with all these problems, all for nothing, to end up losing everything they had. So if you want to know the dummies of World War II, definitely the English. But the Americans are not too far behind. The next section is going to be about Nazi economics. And some of you may have seen my Nazi economics video, and that is what is in the next section. So you may want to skip past it. It's about 50 minutes long. You may want to skip past it and just check out a little section on Hitler as a leader. There are some additional things in there about what Hitler did economically. So, yeah. Okay, let's get into Nazi economics, because I regard this as the crux of the stuff that is hidden away. They don't really want to tell you the real reasons for World War II. The real reasons have got nothing to do with the junk that they put out there. This guy you see here is J.F.C. Fuller. He was a major general in the British Army. And he and another guy were among the first to come up with the concept of how to use tanks in warfare. He was one of the inventors of what you could call armored warfare. And Fuller and this other guy, I forget his name now, they wrote about armored warfare and how to conduct it. And the Germans read this, Guderian in particular read this, but Guderian also wrote his own book. And Guderian actually created an actual working tank army. And in the process, he improved and did various things in order to make it work properly. And Guderian in Germany was really the father of armored warfare. But he drew some of his inspiration from guys like Fuller. So Fuller is pretty honest, and he has an admiration for the German officers. So here is what Fuller says, and he's probably the only guy who ever said this. He said, "What thrust us into war were not Hitler's political teachings. The cause, this time, was his successful attempt to establish a new economy. The causes of the war were envy, greed, and fear." So the real issue for the British was that they had an economic empire, and Hitler was happy to tolerate a British empire. He was all in favor of it. He didn't even want to destroy it at all. But the British saw the real dangers of the Germans. The real issue of the Germans is not that they were dangerous in any way. It was that they were going to be successful. and they were going to be successful politically, but above all, economically. There were many things the Germans did that were completely unique. And we're going to take a look at some of these things, just to give you an idea of what was going on. This guy is Gregor Strasser. He was a major thinker in the Nazi Party, or the NSDAP, which is its real name. And he says, if the machinery for distribution in the present economic system of the world is incapable of properly distributing the productive wealth of nations, then that system is false and must be altered. These German thinkers were incredible, and they came up with really revolutionary ideas. There were lots of things in capitalism that they just dumped. They just threw it on the trash heap and replaced it with something. And therein lies the real key to why these people had to be destroyed. Because they weren't going to be controlled by Jews and the rich. They weren't going to pander to the super rich and lick their boots. They basically said, listen, this stuff here is a scam. That's a lot of rubbish over there. Let's get rid of this. Let's dump that, etc. Therein lies the reality of what they were doing. And that is why these people had to be killed, really. That's why Germany had to be flattened to the ground, was that it had a system that was going to be the best in the world. Now let's take a bit of a look at the German economy. And this is just a quick overview. I myself have not been able to study it properly in depth. And finding proper sources for it is very difficult. And I'm quite convinced that they go out of their way to lie about the German economy, that they try to twist it in various ways so that people don't really see what these Germans were up to. In this chart that you see here, notice 1926 to 1932, and you can see Germany is going downhill. And then in 1932, then here in 1933 is when Hitler becomes the leader of Germany. Hitler becomes the chancellor in 1933. So that is about this level here. And from here onwards, you can see the gross national product in billions of Reichsmarks, and you can see it going up, up, up at a greater and greater pace. So this is 1933 to 1938. So as Hitler came to power, you can just see up, up goes the German economy. And in percentages of increase per year, these green bars show how much it is. So before Hitler came, it had been going downhill. Then from the time that Hitler took over, you can see the change. It was over 5%. You can see it was almost 8 or 9%, 9%, 8%, about 11 or 12%. So you can see that as Hitler takes over, the economy just totally rocks. Eh? Prior to that, it's fumbling and bumbling and stumbling around. The same is true for their politics. Their politics was a mess, total mess, prior to Hitler. And as the Nazi Party came in and they took over, things just started coming right, man. They fixed all the problems. These people were movers and shakers, and they fixed stuff. So here you can see the growth of the GDP of Germany. And this is from 1933, when Hitler comes to power, onwards. This goes to maybe 1939. And you can see just straight up, hey? And the German economy not only goes straight up, but it goes straight up when the American economy is floundering around, everything they're trying is failing, the British economy is floundering around, but the German one under the Nazis, just straight up, man, just rocks. Now, if we look at this chart here, here you can see a wider chart, and here we can see going back to 1926. And this chart is very interesting because it compares the GDP of Germany in blue and its increases with Holland, the Netherlands. So the Dutch aren't Nazis, but so here you can see 1926, how's Germany doing? You can see that the GDP in the Netherlands is growing over 6%. Germany is struggling. Then we see in 27 the Dutch are down a bit and the Germans have a bit of a blast there. But it doesn't last long and the thing falls back. The red line is inflation. It's inflation in Holland and the black line is inflation in Germany. So the German economy is floundering around. And you can see inflation is there, 2% and so forth. They had more inflation than the Dutch. The Dutch even had some negative inflation, in other words, deflation. And then you can see it comes the stock market crash. And you can see the 1929 stock market crash, the start of the Great Depression, which, by the way, is making me think about 2020. Are we in the same thing in 2020 with coronavirus and lockdowns? Are we also heading into the abyss? Are we also heading for World War III? But anyway, so you have this recession, and you can see here, now Germany is really in trouble. The German economy is taking a beating, and you can see 30. And then by 31, it's really just falling down like crazy. Minus 7%, more than 7, minus 7.5 or so. Same here. Meanwhile, while the German economy is totally floundering and flopping, and inflation is just, they've got a heck of amount of deflation, you can see the Dutch are still managing to do better. And then comes 1933. Adolf Hitler becomes the Chancellor of Germany, I think, in January 1933. Becomes the Chancellor of Germany, and suddenly, bang, just look at this. From about minus 7.5 to plus 6, just turns around on a dime. Look at the Dutch. Dutch are still struggling. Then 1934, how's it going? Totally rocking, even more rocking than the year before. Dutch are in big trouble. You can see there's a little bit of inflation in Germany in the beginning. You're looking at less than 4%. And then, as time goes by, you see an amazing thing. The economy is growing like crazy, and the inflation becomes less and less. So the economy is not only growing, but it's growing without inflation. That is amazing. And even more amazing is, do you know, he's doing all of this magic without in any way at all borrowing money from international bankers. He's doing it without the international bankers. Germany is not going into debt. He's pulling off a big magic act over here. Germany is not in debt. Yet the economy is flying like you haven't seen. Look at that. By 1937, it's growing at more than 10% per annum. And now you see the Dutch slowly improving a little bit, then floundering around a bit again. And when the Dutch have got a bit of growth, they get some inflation. But the Germans are rocking and rolling with very little inflation. So that means that the economy is growing in real terms, in real actual terms. So this is the magic show. This is the magic act of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. Total economic success. Turn it around on a dime and straight off economic success, and it's consistent. So that is the magic show. And let's look at a few other points about it. Now, all I'm going to do is I'm going to mention some things to you, but the truth of the matter is that I myself have not dug fully into everything that he did. And I don't believe that people are being truly honest. They are hiding things. It's quite a mission to get data. And I've also picked up bits and pieces from other friends who've been doing research. So I'm going to tell you a couple of things that I know about the Nazi economic system. Because you see, if they turn around and they say, oh, well, you see, the Nazi economic system is like the greatest economic system there is, then what would have happened is everybody else would have wanted to use the Nazi methods. But if you're a lying scumbag Jew, super rich piece of shit, and you are trying to hide your own stuff, and you don't want other people to know that there's something better out there, then of course you don't want people to realize how great this system was. And so this system is strong politically, it's very strong militarily, and it's just as freaking strong economically. This system is unique, totally unique, and it's rocking, man. So just a few points, just to give you a bit of an idea of socialism, German style. Now, I used to think that communism was an evil thing where the government controls everything and socialism is nasty. That would be Jewish communism or Marxism or Bolshevism as we know it, okay? So communism, Marxism, Bolshevism, all the same thing, Jewish garbage. This is the Jewish version of socialism. German socialism is not like Jewish communism. It is actually very humane, and it actually cares for the people. They don't come and starve you to death like the Bolsheviks did to the Ukrainians. They don't come and starve you to death. They don't come and destroy the economy and force you against your will into all kinds of things. The German economy is much more humane, and it works very well. They really care for the people. So German socialism and the socialism that we know as Jewish communism, these are not the same things, okay? They don't work the same, and they don't have those unpleasant, nasty, hideous effects that Jewish communism has. So among the lies, there are so many lies about Hitler and the Germans. And the lies are just arrant, enormous, total garbage. It's huge bullshit, okay? And among the lies that they tell are lies like, oh, Hitler, his economy could only be grown by building the military so that he could go and conquer and expand. And the only way that he could keep the system running was by continuing to conquer. That is the biggest load of bullshit and hogwash ever spoken, man. That is just such crap. That is not what happened at all. If you go and you look at it, all those things, that notion that, oh, the success of the economy was built on the military expansion and the building up of the military, that is just garbage, man. What you've seen there is from 1933 to 1939. Not a single bullet had been fired in that time. So there's nothing there. And whatever he's spending on the military, he's got to pay for it out of the existing economy. He's not only able to build up a military, but he's able to build up a military while the economy is exploding through the roof. He's growing by more than 10% per year in some years. Go and look at how the American economy is doing, or any of the other economies in the world. Look at the South African economy. You will find that for them to get even 2.5% per annum increase in GDP is very rare. In South Africa, that those numbers are not even possible anymore. They can't even do 2.5%. In the time of apartheid and Rhodesia in the 1960s, whites were able to grow the countries in Southern Africa by like 10% per annum at times. Now, Nazi Germany was the same thing. It was growing at a hell of a pace. And not only was it growing at a hell of a pace, it was doing so while he was diverting resources and money to building up the military, which was not gaining him any benefits. There was lots of costs and overheads. And still he managed to do it. And even more miraculous, he did it without borrowing money from international bankers. That is the true great magic here. So he's doing all of this, and Germany doesn't have 1 cent of debt to any banker. Now, another thing about the military was that the German military, Germany was surrounded by other nations that had bigger armies than Germany. Germany had been forced at the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War I. Germany had been forced into having a tiny little army of like 100,000 men. The Germans were denied tanks. They were denied fighter aircraft. I think they were even denied battleships and U-boats, submarines. There were lots of things that the Germans were not allowed to have. So they had a tiny little army of like 100,000 men. It wasn't even properly equipped. And all the most important weapons they weren't allowed to have. While their neighbors had armies that were much bigger and properly armed. So the whole thing that, oh, Hitler militarized because he's a wild man. No, he was just making sure that his country is protected. He had enemies who could invade him, and in fact they did invade him. Right in the beginning of World War II, the French actually attacked and invaded Germany. It's the Sudetenland campaign, by the way. And you can go and read up about it. I've done a video about it. I've mentioned it. But Germany had to build itself up, and you had all this Jewish nonsense going against trying to trip up the Germans. So that is what was happening to the Germans. He had every right and every reason to protect his state. He wasn't doing anything abnormal. And as for the notion that he had set out to just conquer everybody, that's actually not what happened. If you go and you look at different steps, you'll see that others made moves, others caused problems, and he had to take action. About the only time that I know that he went and actually brought another country into the Reich was with Austria. I'm not so sure about Czechoslovakia. I think he brought some people in, some of the Germans in from Czechoslovakia as well. But remember, the German Reich was an ethno-state, and it was an ethno-state for Germans. And so Hitler wanted to find all the Germans, and there were Germans that were living across borders in other countries, and he was bringing them into the Third Reich. The Third Reich was a total German creation, a German ethno-state. Austria, for example, was German. The thing known as the Anschluss, that was the unification of Germany and Austria. And there were referendums for that, etc. And it was not an invasion. It's not the way they characterized it. As the German army moved into Austria, the Austrian army moved into Germany, and more than 90% of the people in Austria voted yes for the Anschluss. Finally, Germans could be together. That is all it was. So when they come and they tell you, oh, he did this and he did that, you need to go and look at the cause and effect, and you'll see that Hitler actually went and invaded other countries as part of other things. Other things happened that dragged him into things, or he had to make moves. Another example, just to give you an example, is Norway. Hitler did not just set out to invade Norway. The reason he invaded Norway was because the British already had a fleet on their way to invade Norway. And so Hitler sees that the British are going to invade Norway, and he decides to beat them to the punch, and he does. So you need to go and study World War II much more closely, and then you'll see that these things are all the things they're telling you. Oh, he was creating this economy by this fake expansion of the military, and therefore he had to keep on conquering and conquering. Bull dust, man. Bull dust. And I'll still tell you about the Russian invasion, because in Russia, the Russians were getting ready to attack the Germans. They were going to attack the Germans in 2 weeks' time. Hitler knew it was coming. They'd watched everything, and Hitler went. Hitler actually made a Napoleon-type move, a preemptive strike. He hit them before they hit him, so that the fighting would take place in their territory and not inside Germany. That's what he did. So anyway, among the other things about Nazism is that you must understand that this system, when I said people have their place and everybody's got his task to do, that doesn't mean that you just get shoved into a position and you stay there for the rest of your life. It doesn't work like that. Germany was a meritocracy, just like Napoleon, just like Napoleon's France was a meritocracy. It was a full-on meritocracy. You got promoted according to your ability. If you could do better at something else, they'd move you somewhere else. They made the best use of their people. It was a meritocracy. There was a chance for upward mobility, etc., etc. All of that was there. So it's not a rigid system. And those guys that you saw with the shovels, the Reich Labor Service wasn't a bunch of white guys who spent the rest of their lives just working with picks and shovels. The Reich Labor Service was actually a service that was like national service. The young men and young women went into the Reich Labor Service for like 2 years. In fact, Germany has got a Reich Labor Service, or a labor service, right to this very day. The Germans have a labor service. It is a necessity in a whites-only country. It is a good feature, and the men and women go and they take part in that kind of work. They do the hard work, they do the miserable work, and they do it as part of growing up. And they go and they spend 2 years doing this work, and they do it in Germany to this day. So it's a feature of a white country. You need to get certain jobs done, and you need to have labor, and the government needs to direct them so that they can get on with strategic things that are for the benefit of the nation. The Nazi system, and just economics in general, our system of capitalism and all that, that's got a lot of rubbish in it, a whole lot of junk in it, which we shouldn't really have. There's all kinds of weird stuff inside capitalism, which makes it inefficient, which makes it duplicate a lot of stuff. There's lots and lots of inefficiencies in capitalism, which I want to go and deal with later. But one of the key things about any kind of economy is that any economy is based on infrastructure. And if you don't, like under apartheid, they built a large amount of infrastructure for South Africa. All of the infrastructure that exists, the highways, the railways, etc., these things were built in the time of Hendrik Verwoerd, in the time of the architects of apartheid. And that infrastructure has served South Africa for decades. Now, if you're going to run a country properly, you need infrastructure, and you need to expand that infrastructure, and you need to change it and modernize it. And businesses are dependent on that infrastructure. So there's always a need to create infrastructure and to improve on the infrastructure. So those are the things you need to think about. And that is what the labor service and the government was trying to do. The government was setting the scene. We need this, we need roads, we need that, we need other things so that we can move forward. Hitler not only had the most family-friendly economy, Hitler also had probably the most pro small business economy that you can get. And Hitler actually, there were lots of Jews in the country, and the Jews, like everywhere, like in South Africa, like in America, like in Britain, like in Europe, the Jews controlled most of the industries and they controlled most of the big businesses. So Hitler saw that there were these chain stores that were owned by Jews and these things that the common man, the common husband or wife running their own little shop cannot compete against big corporate structures. So what Hitler did was he actually banned chain stores. He totally banned them, and that allowed small businesses to survive and carry on. And Hitler also said that it is out of these small businesses that innovation will come. So he banned those things. So those of us who live in South Africa and those of you in America and everywhere else, you've got all these chains, McDonald's, the this, the that. Here in South Africa, we've got tons and tons and tons of chains of stores, okay? All kinds of things, everything from retail to even wholesale. We've got all kinds of big businesses. These kinds of things, they're okay up to a point, but these things also destroy the chance for the small business guy to get off the ground. Who can compete with a pharmaceutical wholesaler that just does as it pleases and it's got masses of money? Who can compete with banks? How can you compete with these things? You can't. These corporates totally sew up everything and they control everything. And so Hitler got rid of these corporates that were smashing down small businesses. So he banned those things, and that allowed small businessmen, shopkeepers, etc., to run their own little businesses, make a living, and so on. And the same is true to a certain degree in Italy. But in Italy, they did allow big business. But even so, among the fascists, you'll find that the people who went to war in World War II were shopkeepers, farmers. Those are the guys who went and killed communists, okay? White guys, and they had their little thing that they were making a living out of. And they were quite happy with the opportunities they were given. Now, with regard to prices, etc., the government made funny moves. And they were creative. So there wasn't like a fixed system of how you do everything. They would look at the country as a whole. And if they decided that they needed something else, let's say they needed to push up production here while reducing the use of resources elsewhere, they would make laws, they would change requirements, and they would force businesses to change. So they'd say, we've got to use less steel over here, but we need more agricultural output over there. And then they would make some changes to rules and I think they'd even influence markets, but they would basically manipulate the situation so that everybody is moving in the direction which is best for the country. And they would make changes all the time. And if they saw, for example, that they needed more materials for the war and they had to cut back on other things, then they'd issue instructions accordingly. But at all times, National Socialism is looking at the nation as a whole and saying what is good for the nation. And if something's not good for the nation as a whole, then that thing gets scrapped. Then that thing is sorted out. Hitler had a Reichsbank, which was like his central bank, but it didn't give him that much money. And Hitler didn't have to borrow from Jews and international businessmen. The real secret to how Hitler financed his stuff was a thing called the MIFO bond. The MIFO bond was an instrument that they came up with, and basically the MIFO bond was a type of a bond that was issued, but when they issued it, they didn't issue it to bankers, etc. They issued it to private people. So anybody could go and buy a MIFO bond. And when you bought an EFO bond, the government would pay you 4% interest. So this is how Hitler raised most of his money. In effect, Hitler was borrowing money from his citizens and paying them interest in return. So rather than going to an international Jewish bank and borrowing from them and paying them interest, he's borrowing from the savings of the people. And it's willing. It's willing. People went and bought these things themselves. And people buy those bonds and the government pays them interest. And because they're quite a low inflation kind of a society, that 4% interest is something real. So he borrows from his people and they in their turn get interest from the government. And the MIFO bonds were among the most fantastic successes of all. This allowed him to raise huge amounts of money. Hitler had a very special place for farming. In opposition to Jewish communism, which hates farmers and tries to destroy farmers and tries to replace farmers with collective farms run by the government, Hitler didn't function like that. Again, it's small business. In other words, the farmer, the normal farmer, runs his little farm. And Hitler even wanted the farmers to remain farmers. He regarded the land so highly that he literally made it illegal for a guy to sell his farm. And he wanted a father to pass his farm on to his son. So that is what Hitler did with the farmers. And the farmers loved it. You know, Hitler made sure that people could have an income, and he adjusted things accordingly so that they could earn money out of their produce. And if it wasn't financially successful, the government would make it financially successful for them so that people could go about their work and do real work in the real world, and it's benefiting the country. But they are looking at the big picture and they are determining what has priority and who needs to be pushed in line, and they would do it that way. It's totally the opposite of current capitalist economics, where everything is just determined by the markets and by consumers. Not at all. The government decides what is best for the country, and it works. And this system allowed them to handle international Jewish boycotts. The Jews could boycott all kinds of things from them, and they would still be able to survive. And they were able to trade and do other things. The system is very strong, and it can handle all kinds of things. So when there are international boycotts, for example, like rubber, they had like sanctions on them, and they couldn't get rubber. So what did the Germans do? They then went and they worked. The government then said, okay, we need rubber. How are we going to get rubber? We don't have plantations. We don't have a way. So the Germans actually, the Nazis, set up a industry to create synthetic rubber. They invented a way to create artificial rubber. And this is how they overcame one problem after another. So their system was tough. And you've got to understand that with any country, that the system as a whole has to be strong. If it's not strong, then it's going to collapse. If an enemy comes and he does something, he puts sanctions on you. You don't want, if somebody comes and puts sanctions on you, that your whole country just collapses in a fucking heap because of a bit of sanctions. You know, those of us who live in Southern Africa, we've experienced sanctions. And Rhodesia experienced more sanctions than anybody else. We had total economic sanctions. We probably had more sanctions on us than any country that ever existed. And you need to have a system that is tough, that can handle that, you see. So that is what they were trying to do. There were big businesses in Germany, but the businesses were not allowed to dictate to the government. The businesses could not be treasonous. The businesses had to do what the government said. So you'll find that in the war, you'll find that big industries came just like America in the modern day. Big companies would come and they would tender for projects, they would offer ideas and so forth. When it came to aircraft and tanks and things, if the government said, you know, we need something like this, the big businesses would go and their experts would draw up plans and they'd come forward with prototypes and they'd say, this is how much it's going to cost, etc. They worked exactly like that. That was how it worked. So Nazism basically took capitalism, and it doesn't destroy capitalism. It just controls it. That's all it does. It doesn't destroy it. It just changes the things that are needed to make it function. So it makes sure that things function that are needed. Like the country needs food. Germany, for example, had a food production problem. There's 70 million Germans, and there's not enough land to produce all the food that the Germans need. So among the things that they would do is they'd have the Reich Labor Service out there going and draining marshes, creating farmland, taking bad land and making it arable so that you can put farmers on there. So they'd go and they'd fix up this land, and then they would actually bring farmers in and let farmers now settle there and start growing food. That is how they functioned. The government makes sure that there's an infrastructure, let's say farmland, and they go and they create it at government cost. And when it's finished, they put people there and they say, right, there you are, you're now settled here. You know, here you go. This is your land, you go and you farm. And they settled people and off they went. This is how they ran their country, and it worked very well. So business doesn't dictate to the government. It's not the tail that's wagging the dog. The government dictates to business, and then they make the necessary changes. And that is how they managed their economy, and their economy functioned. And they literally needed to have the British and American air forces come with thousands of planes to smash them into the ground because their economy was just growing and growing and growing. Their economy at one point almost matched that of the United States of America. They came damn close to it. So the Third Reich was a very successful economic system, but it wasn't just an economic system, it was everything. National socialism is everything. It is a way of thinking, it is a way of life, it is a way of viewing the world, it is a way of looking after your country, it's a way of defending your country, it's a way of working, and it works along with the normal market mechanisms. Things that Hitler got rid of that were a nuisance were things like needless speculation on the stock market. Hitler regarded this as like a waste of energy and a waste of time, and he put rules in place so that you couldn't just go and wildly speculate on the markets endlessly, driving markets up and down, making them unstable, etc. He didn't regard that as important work, and so he instituted a bunch of rules to limit it and to see to it that the markets are stable, etc., and that was that. So it's different to the modern capitalist system of America, etc., where you can have 100,000 people, probably millions even, where you can have hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions, all sitting and speculating on the stock market. That's not productive work. And the Germans have always had a view, right to this day, they have a view that the economy must reflect real work. It mustn't just be a bunch of numbers that come out of all kinds of junk. It's not a Ponzi scheme. It's not a pyramid scheme. It's got to do real work. If it doesn't do real work, then we don't want it. It's got to have real physical consequences for the country. They must be beneficial, otherwise you get rid of it. You don't want 100,000 people doing banking if you can do it with 10,000 people. You've got to make sure that people. The worker is a limited resource, and the worker needs to go and do functioning work. And when you can get, and you get it a lot, in the current free market system, you get a situation where You can have entire industries, huge amounts of people doing lots of duplicated stuff for no reason at all. But it's making money. You can have tons of lawyers pushing papers, and it's absolutely achieving nothing. So why do those things? Stop things where money allows the misallocation of people. And I think that is the key thing here, is that money itself can misallocate people to other jobs that they shouldn't be doing. You know, when I was in the USA and at one of the places with one of my hosts, my one host liked to go and have dinner at a restaurant. So every evening we'd go off to dinner. And I'd watch, you know, here is a white man, and he's relatively young, he's fit, he's healthy. Why is he doing the job of a waiter? Why is he doing that work? Isn't there more important work for him to do? And those are the kinds of questions that I ask more and more about all of us, especially men. How many jobs are men doing that they shouldn't be doing, that should either be allocated to women or not done at all, or done in a very limited way? You know, another example is attorneys, you know. How many attorneys do you need? How many laws and things do you need? There are some things where you need to look at the people and the skills, and you've got to say, is this really good for the country? If it's not good, then reduce some of the stuff and let's move on, you know. Or rather than having lawyers who've got to go through mountains of papers, maybe you need to make things simpler so it can be done faster, so that either you don't need a lawyer and you can do it yourself. You know, those are the kinds of things. Even here in South Africa, under apartheid, they tried to think up things that were more efficient. Like the small claims court is an example where... And even companies, forming of companies, they'd make things so simple so that people could do more of that and that things could move on. And that's the key here, is not to be a slave to money, not to be a slave to consumerism, not to be a slave to all kinds of weird things. Make sure that the work that you're doing is beneficial for the country and that everybody is working on something that is useful for the country. If you don't do that, you're wasting your time. You're wasting your skills and your talents. You should be doing things that are useful. And that is all that Nazism was trying to do. They were trying to make sure that everybody is working on something that has meaning for the country. And you can see just in those first few years, you can see straight away from the moment that they put those regulations in place that off they went. Straight off, one time. You're not worried about markets. You're not worried about other people. You're not even worried about sanctions. Hitler had other more advanced things. He was trying to create a trading union in the center of Europe. He was trying to create an economic bloc. He also bartered goods. They did lots of things that they needed to do. They weren't like communists at all. They were just trying to fix things and make sure that things work. And they used their intelligence and they tried to make things move as fast as possible with the least amount of effort. And I think that for a whites-only country, that is critical stuff. You need that kind of stuff. Stop being a fucking slave to the markets and to fashion and all kinds of nonsense and junk, making money out of rubbish. There are lots and lots of things that are really rubbish, that are rubbish occupations. You're making money and wasting time and resources and electricity and so forth on junk. Get rid of junk and focus on work that is real. Stuff that benefits the people, that benefits the nation, and get rid of all this other garbage and make sure that people are skilled up and they move up in life. And people can change jobs. I mean, this is just a capitalist system, but it's a controlled capitalist system. And people can change jobs and do things and off they go. Everybody's got... finds what he wants to do and so forth. But there are some things like the Reich Labor Service where you go and do it like you do military service, you know. So a very reasonable system. Nothing nasty, but it's not controlled by the elite. It's not controlled by Jews. Jews who are globalists do not sit there and tell you what to do. Not at all. That's what the government is there for. The government's job is to do what is good for the nation. And it's got to find the answers. And then it has the power to issue the orders. So that's just a bit of an insight into the economic system, which I regard as the biggest secret of all. And I've still got a number of other things I need to read and go through with regard to this. They didn't have fixed rules. They were very creative. So they would look at a situation and say, we've got this thing, we've got that thing, how are we going to do this, how are we going to solve it? And they came up with all kinds of creative solutions to things. It was not a rigid system like the communists, and it wasn't about stealing everybody's possessions. Anyway, the communists steal everybody except the bank's possessions. You know, the original communism, for example, will steal the land. It'll try and steal all what's called the means of production, but it won't go and steal the bank's money because the banks were in the hands of the Jews. So these are just some of the background to this whole thing so that you can understand what they were trying to do. And actually it was very reasonable, very logical, and they just tried to control things so that the country functioned in a reasonable way that benefited the nation as a whole and the people as a whole. And out of this system came lots of other things. Hitler was also, he also enacted the first animal-friendly laws. Hitler banned the hideous practice of kosher slaughter of animals. It is out of this same system that you get annual paid leave. And the government even organized cruises and things for workers to go overseas to travel at discounted rates. Do you know that the British were so threatened by this system that prior to World War II, they even stopped German ships from coming into British harbors. They did not want the British worker to see how well the German workers were doing. That is how threatened they were by this system. Many things that you think are modern were invented by the Nazis. And nobody will tell you, Nazis invented those things. Next time you take paid leave, remember, invented by Adolf Hitler. Next time you go to the gym at your work, remember, that comes from Adolf Hitler. All these different things. Better working conditions. Nazis invented that. Not communists, not Jews. Nazis invented that. So there you have it. The greatest secret of all, Nazi economics. The most hidden thing of all. And by no means am I finished. I still need to spend time on this in a later time. This is actually the heart and soul of it. Something I've not even mentioned. Oh, goodness, I've not even mentioned families. Let me just quickly mention families. If you got married in Nazi Germany, the government gave you a house. In fact, it gave you a house with quite a big area that you could plant a garden on. You could literally feed your family from your garden. So if you got married, I think you got a house and a car. Then with every child that you got, the government would get rid of your debt by 25% for each child. So if you and your wife had four children, all your debt was written off. All of your debt was written off. It was gone. So when you get the house, you've got to pay interest on it at a low rate. There is a low interest rate. But as you have children, they just come and they just knock off the debt. So if you've got two children, for example, the government would knock off half of your debt. If you have four children, then all your debt is written off. And your house is yours, your car is yours, finished. It's a done deal. That's it. So the Germans aren't firm on the notion of paying interest. If you behave in a certain way, then your interest payments will disappear and your debt will disappear. And the next thing you'll find is that you are free of debt. All you have to do is have four children and you're debt free. End of story. So there's no better family friendly system than that. The government made it easy for people to have children, for people to get married. These are the things these people were trying to do. Absolutely unique. No communist does that. In fact, the Jews in Russia issued a statement that any man who wanted to make a woman pregnant, he could make her pregnant and she had to accept it. It basically like turned a woman into like a prostitute. That is what the communists did. Totally different system. Totally anti-natural. Whereas these guys were trying to build up family and that kind of thing. That's what they were trying to do, and they were successful. So a completely different system. It's not about the system favoring the rich, and the rich come and they put you in a debtor's prison or whatever. It is about things that will benefit the worker and allocating the worker so that he does that which is the most important. And it makes for a very, very strong, very efficient system. I like this statement here. Life doesn't forgive weakness. When you understand more about the philosophy of Nietzsche, then you will understand exactly how true this is. This is the truth. This is the way life is. Life is competitive, very competitive. And the weak don't make progress. The strong might make progress. The weak definitely won't make progress. So there you have it. Anyway, it's a good statement that. And here is something else said by Adolf Hitler. The doom of a nation can be averted only by a storm of flowing passion, but only by those who are passionate themselves can arouse passion in others. So that's how it is. And that is what he was trying to do. He was trying to save Germany. And all of them were working their asses off to save Germany, while Jews were trying to trip up Germany and fuck it up for Germany and end up fucking it up for everybody in the Western world. How's that? So the wrong people won and the good people lost. Here's something that one of my supporters in New Zealand sent me, which just adds to the economic stuff. I just want to go through it quickly. Adolf Hitler's first 100 days, these are the things he did. Pulls Germany out of the globalist League of Nations. I'm in agreement with that. I hate the United Nations as well. Bans the Communist Party and arrests its leaders. Yep, Adolf Hitler was the greatest communist fighter of all time. Nobody fought communism more than Hitler and the Germans. That is a fact. Nobody has ever even come close to what Hitler and the Germans did in fighting Jewish Bolshevism. Then it says he implements strength through joy, affordable luxury vacation program, establishes NSDAP as Germany's only political party. That I don't know so much. I read in de Grel's book, Leon de Grel's book, that there were other political parties. Hitler didn't wipe out the others. The others ended up losing their own momentum because they realized that it's not politics as normal and that everything the Nazis are doing is correct. So eventually they lost interest because they realized it was a waste of time to go against Hitler because everything Hitler wants to do is good. And that's also part of this stupid democracy nonsense, you know. Sometimes democracy is just a load of garbage, and you don't actually need all that playing on the floor of the Congress or the floor of the Parliament. It's all nonsense. So anyway, ends reparations payments from Versailles Treaty, takes control of the Reich Bank. The Reich Bank is the central bank. It's like the Fed. Issues debt-free currency. Restricts Jewish ownership of radio and newspaper. That's always a good idea. Cuts taxes and provides incentives for mothers to stay at home and raise children. Relaxes the strict gun control of the previous government. And by the way, there's a lot of nonsense doing the rounds about Hitler introducing gun control. That's garbage. That's garbage. They allowed people to shoot more than ever. And then finally, it rebuilds German infrastructure and initiates the Autobahn highway system. So that's Adolf Hitler's first 100 days. Pretty impressive, hey? Nobody in this modern, useless world can do even a tenth of this. Even 5% of this would be too much for the worthless dogs who rule many countries. Of South Africa, I don't even speak. So fucking retarded, you can't believe it. So here is the next thing, and this is very important. This adds to what I was saying about Hitler and what he did for Germany. In this table here, this is really a fantastic table. Look at all these top Western countries. Most of them are Western countries except for Japan. And you can see 1929, things are looking quite good. But thanks to the stock market crash, by 1932, it's a nightmare. You can see the world index of unemployment has jumped from 5.4 to 21. I assume this is percent. So if you look here, you'll see Australia 29% unemployment, Austria 26, Canada 26, Czechoslovakia not too bad. Then you can see Germany 30%, Denmark 31%. Czechoslovakia and Japan seem to be the two that came out the best. They weren't as heavily affected. But everybody else was above 20%. Netherlands 25, Norway 30. Poland not too bad. And then you can see Sweden, United Kingdom 22%. Then jump from 1932 to 1937 and you see that Germany has gone from 30% unemployment to 4.6%. And by the next year, 1938, it's down to 2.1%. So between 32 and 38, unemployment in Germany is the lowest in the developed world. He's gone from one of the worst in the developed world to the best, probably in the entire world. Of the entire developed world, even beats Japan. 6 years, and that's Adolf Hitler. Now, Roosevelt came to power in 1932, the year before Hitler, and he did all his big plans with his Jews and Jewish communists that were in his government. And despite all their big moves, by 1937, they'd only got it down to 13.2%. Whereas Hitler, with a worse, Hitler starting after Roosevelt, with a worse situation than Roosevelt, he's whipping Roosevelt's ass. And then you can see that by 1938, look at it, Roosevelt even can't totally stop it. It actually starts getting worse. Look at that. Britain and the United States are getting worse than the year before. But Hitler, he's just moving forward, man. He's just dropping that unemployment rate. Yeah, and if you look at all these others, you'll see Canada was down to 12.5, then it went to 15%. Belgium dropped to 13.1, then it went to 17. Australia was okay. But Hitler is the best on this entire list. He cleans everybody's clock. He turns Germany around. He does what nobody else in the world can do, and he does it right away, straight off. He pulls off an immense achievement. So don't let anybody ever tell you, oh, Hitler, he did this and he did that and he didn't know how to do this. He was dependent on war. All that's bullshit. This is all before the first shots of World War II were fired. And anyway, the first shots were fired because they were busy murdering Germans in Poland. You never get to hear about the 54,000 Germans who were murdered in Poland before Hitler decided enough of this shit. The United States has gone to war twice, in World War II and on 9/11, for about 3,000 dead. Hitler waited until 54,000, or was between 54 and 56,000 Germans were killed before he decided that enough's enough. You cannot fault Hitler on patience. He bent over backwards, and other people were busy creating problems so that he had to do things. Lots of stuff about Hitler and the Nazis that you never hear about. Everything, they're lying left, right, and center. But anyway, there you have it. Hitler, unquestionably the greatest leader in the entire Western and developed world. Unmatched. If you look at that chart, he's unmatched. He's got no equals. He pulled off the impossible. He doesn't even get the credit for that. If you want an ethnostate in the future, whites are going to have to create countries and secede and either engage in secession, or you may find that the blacks or the Jews or some other assorted scum organized by the Jews will be attacking the whites. So at some point, whites will have to go it alone and maybe even just decide we're going to create our country and we're going to decide when we're going to be independent. So that would be a lot like Rhodesia rebelling against Britain in 1965. UDI, a unilateral declaration of independence. Nobody's going to give you a country. You're going to have to seize it yourself. You're going to have to determine your own timetable. And you're going to have to say, well, screw you, I'm out. And we're going to do our own thing. Of course, what will happen is the same as happened to Rhodesia, is the same as happened to Germany, is the same as happened to South Africa, is that people are going to go to war against you. Jews will organize enemies for us the moment that we want to be free and we want to be whites doing our own thing. White people are not allowed to be free. Jews do not like it. The system they want is capitalism, where money and financial things dominate the country, determine the country's fate, and the common white person cannot determine his own fate. All of politics everywhere in the Western world is not controlled by whites. Common whites all want the same things, but they're not allowed to have it. And you'll see that billionaires, bankers, Jews, Freemasons, and assorted scum are determining the fate of white nations. That is why all these nations are becoming diverse and non-white, and whites are becoming a minority. It's because whites are not in charge, and all the whites in all those countries are hating it more and more. So the future is ethnostates, and you're going to have to take risks. Life is not without risk. Life is not without risk, and it's not without danger. But that is natural, and it's always been that way. And we're an old people. We've been at this for a long time. So if it was good enough for the Romans and the Greeks and the Aryans and the Hittites and all the others who came before, it's good enough for us. And I will remind you once again, finally, from Savitri Devi, that one does not become a national socialist. One only discovers, sooner or later, that one has always been one. And when you understand more about the system and you understand more about Nietzsche and all the various lines of thinking in the system, you will understand why this is a fantastic system. But the thing I wanted to show you was that men are men, women are women, and look at how happy these people are. And there are lots of babies in the system. The system is designed so that we are going to have children, so that there's a future, so that we are not outnumbered, so that the future is built by the children, and we prepare everything for the children, and so that there is a future forever for whites. That is the important thing. So, Adolf Hitler, the most family-friendly ruler in the history of the white race. And of course, all you've ever heard are bad things because the people putting it out are Jews, and Jews hate this. They hate it when whites want to be by themselves because Jews need to wangle their way in among whites, and Jews are now dragging in blacks and Asians and everybody else into the system because they can't stand the notion that whites want to be by themselves and that whites will also kick Jews aside. Because Jews won't work in this system. Jews don't like this kind of system. Jews are not common workers. This is a system for common working people, and it's a system that works. It's a system that took 70 million people and produced one of the most powerful states that has ever existed, with only a tiny population of 70 million people. This state was able to fight three enormous empires at the same time, and it almost beat them. That is the power of this system. This system is a strong system. You can't come and sabotage it. You can't come and scare these people. These people can do their own work. They can fight for themselves. They can look after themselves. They are strong as a result of this system. This system makes you extremely strong. And their system is such that economically, militarily, politically, they can take any beating that you can hand out to them. So they did amazing stuff. They created an incredible system. The only sadness is that countries like Britain, France, America were working on the side of the Jews. The Jews themselves have said that. You can go and find it and read up on it, and you'll see the Jews have said, we must support Britain, France, and America because they are fighting our greatest enemy, the state of this German state. So that is the real thing here. World War II was not about the fact that Hitler was evil. World War II was about the fact that whites were ruling themselves and they broke away from Jewish control. That's what they did. They broke away from Jewish control and the Jews had to destroy them. They had to find other countries to destroy them. Otherwise, they would have become the greatest nation on the face of the earth. And Europe would have become unconquerable. It would have been that powerful. The fascists are also racists, but they aren't as well organized, and their thinking isn't as deep and scientifically accurate as that of the Germans. But they were allies, they did work together, and they did support each other. So, whether you're a Nazi or a fascist, you are still a racist, you still want to be in a whites-only state. But the fascists weren't as racial, and the fascists also teamed up with the rich. And they even let Jews into the system. And then you've got to ask yourself, by teaming up with the rich and having many Jews inside the fascist system, is that not the reason for so many disasters that later befell Italy? And that's a whole other story. Leon de Grelle himself tells you that. He says to you that that is where the problems came from. That all the things that dragged Germany down in World War II came from Italy. Leon de Grelle says that. But I think that it's because the Italians tolerated the Jews. They had lots of Jews in the fascist party, and they were teaming up with money. That's the weakness of fascism. So fascism is like halfway to national socialism, but it's not gone far enough. The proper way to do this is to be national socialist. Then everybody's got their place, everybody works, the system is otherwise democratic, and the system is there for the benefit of the masses. It is there to benefit everybody, and the worker gets lots of things. There are many things that came out of Germany that we have today. Nobody will tell you this, but things like having an annual paid leave, that was a Nazi invention. Nazis came up with that. Prior to Nazis, there was no such thing as annual paid leave by your work. They also brought in gyms at the work. They brought in all kinds of things to improve the situation of the worker. The worker got better paid than ever before. Lots and lots of things were better. The worker enjoyed the system. That is why those workers went and fought for the system. Even the Italians also, small shopkeepers, people with small businesses, farmers, shopkeepers, they went and picked up machine guns and went to fight the enemy because they loved their system. Their system meant something to them. So that is why these people were strong, and that is why there were women who were, you know, notorious Nazis. Why? Because they loved children. And that's what women should be doing. So this is just misrepresented. You've only heard lies and you haven't even studied the system. It's a fantastic system. So if you want an ethno-state and you're serious about one, you better study Nazi Germany. You're going to learn a lot. The Germans figured out literally everything you can imagine. They were way ahead of their time. As far as I'm concerned, the Germans were centuries ahead of everybody else. Centuries ahead. You want to know what the system should be like 300 years from now? It should be Nazis. Whites who are Nazis in spaceships. I'm telling you, everything that the Western world has today, that the Americans boast about, whether it is tank-killing aircraft, whether it is helicopters, whether it is intercontinental ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, you name it. All those things, jet aircraft, all those things were invented by Germans. Almost exclusively. Not always, but almost exclusively. Yes, Frank Whittle did invent the jet engine in Britain, but the Germans also built jet engines. And they had the first ones in working planes. So lots and lots of fantastic stuff came out of that system. Lots of science and technology and tremendous progress came out of that system. That system was almost invincible. It took three empires and a whole bunch of other nations to break them. That's how tough they were. And as always, when the English-speaking, the Anglo-American English-speaking side of our world, under the control of Jews, whenever they can't beat an enemy in a fair fight, like the British couldn't beat the Boers on the battlefield, and like the British and Americans couldn't beat the Germans in a straight fight, then what they do is they come and they murder your women and children. They firebomb Dresden, just like they put the Boer women and children in concentration camps. Rest assured, when whites go and whites start standing together and uniting as one, you will hear never-ending cries of racism, racism, Nazi, racism, fascist, Nazi. You'll hear that every day of your life. Because Jews don't want it to happen. That's why every Western country is flooded with non-whites. Everybody's a liberal. Everybody's learning diversity. Why? Because Jews want that, not the whites who live there. Do you really think that the whites who live in Sweden and Norway and Italy, that they all want non-whites in their countries? No fucking ways. Neither do the Canadians, neither do the Australians, neither do the Americans. Whites want to be together, but the people in charge are not white. And they hate it when whites stand together. But this is the most powerful system ever invented. And if more whites used this system, we would be invincible. And we are all derived from Europe. This is our system, and it's based on the excellence and the historical traditions of Europe. Traditions that work and science that works. So, you want to get serious about whites-only states? Start studying Nazi Germany. You've got a lot to learn. They are way ahead. They were way ahead of everybody. They would have become the world's greatest superpower. That's why they had to engineer a war to destroy them. But any time that whites want to be free, I'm going to repeat myself, any time that whites truly want to be free, you will find that Jews are there to trip you up, and Jews will create the enemies that will be attacking you. They will. They cannot stand it. They hate whites from Europe. They hate European people. They hate everybody who's descended from European ancestry. They hate them. And they don't want to see them succeed racially. So just keep that in the back of your head. But if enough whites push this thing forward, this is our system. This is our system, and it's a powerful system. And that's why Jews and others go crazy when this thing is around. All these globalists, faggots, Freemasons, they don't want this stuff. It's going to break up what they've got. They've got a good gig going, stealing from the white man and cheating the white race. So they don't want whites to get organized like this. So final word from Savitri Devi, one does not become a National Socialist. One only discovers sooner or later that one has always been one. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.